This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening, I'm Ezra Zide. Tonight is another episode of Finding the Funny. Finding the Funny is where we'll be speaking to and speaking about people who are in this funny business of entertainment and comedy. So be it stand-up comics, writers, hosts, actors and beyond, we'll be discussing everything from their work, their inspirations, and what decisions and relationships impacted their craft. But here's the thing. Tonight, we're actually not going to be focusing on a particular comedian. I thought we'd try something different. You see, in the past week or so, and once again, listeners, you'll be kind to indulge me on this, I haven't been quite my normal self. Very recently, in the space of 3 days, my family and I had been dealt with an emotional blow. We lost 2 very close relatives, each to their own respective circumstances. Now, I won't do an Oprah, if that's even a verb, I think I just made that up, but I won't be quite telling you how I feel about recent events, but it did strike me that the topic of death or mortality, which by consensus is not very funny at all, it has always had an interesting relationship with comedy and humor. Does humor have a role in making sense of death or tragedy? Is it appropriate? When is it healthy or unhealthy to make light of such grim circumstances? So, this evening, we'll be finding the funny in death. I think to set the stage, and maybe in trying to reconcile death and comedy, let's hear a comedian's take on death. Now, after some research, there aren't an abundant amount of comedians who use it as key material. I mean, why talk about death when you can talk about heartbreak, your in-laws, boyfriends, girlfriends, office colleagues, ethnic groups, behaviors, trends, and whatever other observation that can be made of those who are alive and well? But for the ones who do address the issue of death, or for those who joke about it, it's by no coincidence that they're some of the most influential comedians we've ever seen.
You're all going to die. Didn't mean to remind you of it, but it is on your schedule.
Have a listen to this bit by George Carlin.
Oh, they say the nicest things about you. They say the nicest things when you die. Your popularity goes straight up when you die. They say the greatest things there are that can be said. They'll even make stuff up if they have to.
Well, he was a real but he meant well, you know? He's a well-meaning. Yes, you get so popular when you die. All the flowers you get. Think of the flowers you get when you die. You get more flowers when you die than you got in your whole life. All your flowers arrive at once, too late. The guys will say, oh, yeah, well, you know, Bill is dead. Yeah, poor Bill. Poor Bill is dead, yeah. Poor Dave? Yeah, poor Dave is gone now. Ed? Yeah, poor Ed is gone. Dan? Still alive, isn't he? I wish he would die so I could like him. The only reason that I even suggest that you have a choice about what you can do at the moment of death is a very little known and very little understood part of the death process called the 2-minute warning. Many people are not aware of it at all. The 2-minute warning. Just as in football, 2 minutes before you die, you receive an audible warning.
2 minutes, get your shit together.
The reason we don't know about it is because the only people who hear it die. And I don't think we'd believe someone anyway if he told us he received his 2-minute warning, would you? Some on the bus?
Hey, I just got my 2-minute warning.
You'd think it was a coach out on the town, you know? But no, the 2-minute warning does arrive. And I say use that time to entertain to leave something behind. Do something with the 2 minutes. Hey, if nothing else, give a speech. Little 2 minute speech. We can all give a little 2 minute speech. Just pick some subject you're very fond of and talk about it for 2 minutes. I mean, tell them it's your last chance to tell them anything. So tell them, got 2 minutes, and I mean, wax eloquent, rise, bring it to the rafters, and then at the moment at the end, you say, if this is not the truth, may God strike me dead.
Folks, this evening we're exploring the topic of death and humor. That was George Carlin doing a monologue on it. After this, we look at other comedians or artists who use this particular theme, and we'll see how they included it into their creative works. Stay tuned to Finding the Funny on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. Good evening, I'm Ezra Zide. It's Finding the Funny featuring the Grim Reaper. Well, no, the Grim Reaper is the name of a particular comedian, but we are exploring the relationship between humor or comedy and how that translates to something on the other side of the scale, death. Something that, I think you might agree, isn't necessarily so funny, if at all. And so when you think about the issue of mortality, no other writer or comedian or artist has continuously dealt with this topic as much as Woody Allen. There's an old joke he tells in the opening monologue of his film Annie Hall. It's one of his classic films, which leads him to this particular view on life.
There's an old joke. Two elderly women are at a Catskill Mountain resort, and one of them says, "Boy, the food at this place is really terrible." The other one says, "Yeah, I know, and such small portions." Well, that's essentially how I feel about life. Full of loneliness and misery and suffering and unhappiness, and it's all over much too quickly.
And if you wonder whether this constant examination of existentialism or mortality or death in all of his films over the past 3 decades or so, whether this theme has changed or improved...
2 days ago, Portuguese filmmaker Manuel de Oliveira was here, and he said that life is all about uncertainties. The only certainty we have is death, which matches perfectly with the title of your new film. So I'd like to ask, how's your relationship with death now?
My relationship with death remains the same. I'm strongly against it. And, you know.
And to really understand how a writer or comedian like Woody Allen has such a pessimistic view of life, we can point to the beginning and how this notion created the blueprint for his creative works.
My mother always used to say I was a very sweet, happy kid right from the start. And then somewhere around 5 or so, I turned grumpier or sour. I can only think when I became aware of my mortality, I didn't like that idea. What do you mean this ends? This, you know, this doesn't go on like this? No, it ends. You know, you vanish forever. Once I realized that, I thought, hey, you know, deal me out. I don't want to play in this game. And I never was the same after that. And that thought over the years took different forms as I later got older and always used my concentration camp example of people around me having fun, enjoying themselves. And I want to say, but don't you realize you're going to go up in a smokestack, you know, in a short while? So why are you so happy? I mean, doesn't that thought sort of put a damper on things? I'm not saying my grim appraisal is right. Of course, I think it is. But this was only my particular take on everything, that we all know the same truth and our lives consist of how we choose to distort it.
You know, you start to think when you're younger how important everything is and how things have to go right, and your job, your career, your life, and your choices and all that. And then after a while, you start to realize that, I'm taking the big picture here, that eventually you die, and eventually the sun burns out and the earth is gone, and eventually all the stars and all the planets, the entire universe goes, disappears, and nothing is left at all. Nothing Shakespeare's or Beethoven or, you know, all gone, Michelangelo, gone. And you think to yourself, it is a lot of noise and sound and fury. And where's it going? Not going anyplace. It's going, you know. And then every 100 years, it's like the whole planet gets washed clean of everybody on it. All these people that are making your life miserable, your next door neighbors, your people that are robbing you in the street, and, you know, all gone. The president and the bank robber, and they all out. So, you know, it just seemed like a big, meaningless thing. Now, you can't actually live your life like that, because if you do, you just sit there and why do anything? Why get up in the morning and do anything? So I think it's the job of the artist to try and figure out why, given this terrible fact, why do you want to go on living? Why do you care about anything if this terrible truth is there, this meaningless end of everything? And you have to try and figure out, knowing that it's true, not giving yourself a fake heaven and hell and nonsense, but knowing the worst, figure out, even knowing the worst, why it's still worthwhile. That's a tough assignment to explain to somebody why it's so terrible and why it's still important to go on. And this is a challenge for artists all the time, to try and figure it out.
After this, to find out whether there is a role for humor in dealing with grief or death or tragedy, I speak to a psychiatrist. This is Finding the Funny, where we are exploring humor and death. Don't go anywhere. BFM 89.9. Good evening, it's Finding the Funny, I'm Ezra Zayed, and thus far we've been examining the relationship between humor and death. Yes, not so funny topic, but challenge accepted. Now, all of us are aware of the inevitability of life's final process, yet most of us have difficulty lightening up about it. Lots of folks believe that death is, quote, serious business, and therefore seldom see any place for humor in it. But humor can do other things, such as A. provide relief for our anxieties about death, B. help us cope with the death of others, and C. ease the stress that often surrounds grief. But that's just my uneducated opinion about it. So to find out whether there's any relationship between humor or comedy and death, I spoke to someone who knows a little bit more about it than I do.
Hello.
Hi, Dr. Stephen. Ezra here.
Yes, Ezra. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for speaking to me.
This is Associate Professor Dr. Stephen Jambanathan. He's a psychiatrist who deals with analytic psychotherapy. And so for his line of work, understanding the nature of grief is a huge part of that. To kick things off, what is it about the idea of death that makes it such an awkward and difficult topic for people to deal with?
Well, the idea of death itself is a kind of untangler. You know, you don't say, when you die, I'm going to do this. When you die, I'm going to do that. Because it's like, oh, so you want me to die? The thing is, I wonder sometimes, what's wrong with death? And for that matter, what's wrong with talking about death? It's a natural thing. The thing is, people are sometimes afraid that if they talk about it, some form of superstition, they worry, oh, if we talk about it, it might happen.
And specifically for people who are in grief, perhaps mm-hmm. those who are in mourning over the loss of their loved ones, can you give us an idea as to what happens to them psychologically? What takes over?
Well, when somebody is hit with something, a strong emotional blow, namely in this case grief, a lot of past psychological experiences are activated. And very often grief is a reminder of a lot of things that have happened in the past, a lot of guilt of what could have been done, what should have been done, what we didn't do, and the person is gone. Again, depending on your social cultural beliefs and your religion, the process of losing somebody, what we call grief, in some cultures is actually a celebration. Now, some people put an age to it after 70, after 88, to celebrate somebody's life. But for some people, it's, sadly, when kids die early, it's to celebrate whatever life they had. How people deal with grief depends on the family, depends, again, on the culture. Some people actually have anticipated grief. And when a person in the family is ill for a very long time, they actually go through the process of grief even before the person passes on. And after death comes a huge sigh of relief. Thank God it's over. No more suffering.
And so there's that cliche about how, you know, laughter is the best medicine. I think we've all seen that in Reader's Digest for some reason. So how helpful is humor or jokes or comedy in these scenarios? Is it a cathartic process?
It is cathartic. It is a very good form of dealing with grief. It is a very good form of opening channels and harnessing support from others. However, now, if let's say there were five people in a family grieving and four were able to joke about the loss of a parent, what about the fifth person? It may not go down too well for the fifth person, because this person may not have his or her issues resolved. There may be a lot of unresolved issues. So it can be a very sensitive issue. But yes, if one is able to joke about it, make fun of it with respect and in good taste, it can be a very therapeutic process.
And, of course, just to reverse it, we've seen how also people jump to jokes and comedy as a defense mechanism, basically acts as a barrier to actually dealing with the issue at hand. Has that been something you've observed as well?
Yes, good question. Now, that would be a form of denial, where humor can be a form of defense, a kind of defense mechanism. If it goes on for too long and if it causes a dysfunction, then it's not good, because you're just sort of bypassing the whole episode of loss. However, some people have this initial defense of humor, and then later it sinks in, delayed grief. It is a natural process, so it can be an initial way of dealing with death, and then later dealing with grief the correct way. It is a protective mechanism, because initially, well, one might joke about it and subconsciously prepare yourself for dealing with it. And at the right time, a month later or a week later, God, my dad is gone, or my mom is gone. And then starts the grief. So it's actually a temporary protective mechanism.
That makes your job a lot more difficult. So to some degree, you have to be cautious and judicious about how patients are reacting to the experience of grief, even though they display initial reactions or emotions that may be contrary to what they're actually feeling.
Yes. So what we've got to do from the psychiatric or psychological point of view is to be a very neutral sounding board and help this person work through it themselves. Sometimes, some psychiatrists believe in bursting the bubble before it gets too big. But when it comes to grief, I believe you should allow the bubble to expand and expand and expand and burst at its own time. Basically, to lepas angin lah, to let it out.
Is there a particular experience that you've had in which comedy or humor has proved an interesting gateway for a particular process for a patient?
Yes. Not many times, but a few times I have been able to joke about a relative who died a very funny death, because she was a chronic smoker.
Okay.
An elderly lady, and before she died, she came out, she rushed out with cancer, advanced cancer, smoked her last cigarette, emptied her bowels and scolded people around her, and then just fell flat.
Wow, and she just fell flat like that?
Yeah, and here the whole family, we were crying, of course, but by the next day, we were laughing and joking about how she decided to leave. just like the old strong woman she was in the past. Scold and go.
There you go. Thank you very much, Dr. Stephen. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Stay tuned for more on Finding the Funny, featuring the Grim Reaper in trying to make sense of death and comedy. This is BFM 89.9.
I'm Ezra Zayed, and this is Finding the Funny. And so tonight, we've been exploring the relationship of humor or comedy in the context of death. And so we've discovered it is a complex combination. It's a pairing that's unusual but familiar. It's foreign to others but quite common for some. To end the program tonight, I'll be sharing with you a bit by Louis C.K. Now, if you haven't seen the series Louis, it's starring, written, edited, and directed by the man himself. The show puts a spotlight on CK's everyday life and ordeal and his quest to find love and his pursuit of humor. And for you right now, here's Louis C.K. talking about death in one of his most recent stand-up specials. Have a listen.
But I'm really glad you're here. This is a sizable crowd. This is a big place. It's about 2,500 people here. And that's a lot of people. That's enough people to be like a sample of the population. 2,500 people is enough people that you're all going to experience a lot. There's enough people here to say that within 2 months, at least one of you will die. I'm just saying, I think it's probably accurate to say that out of any random group of 2,500 people, not all of you are gonna make it to Christmas, unfortunately. There's gonna be at least one of you here tonight is going to ruin your family's Christmas by dying a death. And I don't know who it is, I'm sorry. I don't know, your death is whatever. Some people, they want you to do things when they die with their, like, I want you to take my ashes and sprinkle. F*** you, I'm not doing none of that. You're dead. I'm not gonna run errands for you after you're dead. You don't matter anymore. Some people try to do something, you know, noble with their bodies. They try to have their bodies have some use after they're dead, which I think is a good thought. You're only borrowing your body. You're only borrowing everything. If your body's worth anything when you're done with it, you should pass it on. That's something I really believe. I mean, I'm not gonna do it because I don't want to. Ew, it's mine. I have a lot of beliefs and I live by none of them. That's just the way I am. They're just my beliefs. I just like believing them. I like that part. They're my little believies. They make me feel good about who I am. But if they get in the way of a thing I want or I want to, oh gosh, I do that. But some people take their body. My grandma, grandmother, she just for the layman. My grandmother, she gave her body to a medical school. For it to just be examined and dissected, which is a good thought for that, but you know, her survivors, her family, that was a person. That was my grandmother. She used to wear glasses and say things. And now she's just shaved head on a metal table with a hungover medical student trying to dig out her pancreas, and he gets an F. Imagine being the body where the kid got an F on you. The teacher's like, no, you idiot. And he writes F on her with a Sharpie and just throws her down a chute on a pilot F body.
Folks, I hope you've enjoyed the program. If you missed any part of it, or if you'd like to download other episodes of Finding the Funny, you can go to www.bfm.my to download the podcast. Send your feedback, good and bad, to feedback@bfm.my. And on a final note, or rather a personal one, this goes out to two very special people, both who were in their own right very funny people. And this episode was inspired by my uncle Suflan, as well as my grandmother To'umi, both whom very recently passed away. You've been listening to Finding the Funny with me, Ezra Zayed, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.